The designated hour having arrived, I call to order this special meeting of Ansel Glink's Quorum Forum podcast, the podcast local governments need to do business. In the chair, it's me, Daniel J. Bolin, and on our agenda, it's another election special, and this time we're talking about issues for local governments and electoral boards. But first, let's take the roll. Engineer Rick?
Present.
Engineer Rick is present. We have a quorum. Podcast regular Carrie Lynn Krafteffer is an equity partner at Ansel Glink, and you know she represents politicians and candidates in election law matters, including ballot access, referenda, campaign finance, and related matters. And, you know, we've talked about elections in the past, but, you know, elections aren't just for the candidates. Local governments have a lot to do to make elections happen. You have local election officials have their duties, and electoral boards to hear challenges to nomination papers. And then there's campaign issues like political sign regulations and electioneering around polling places. And sometimes local governments get involved themselves with their own referenda, which leads to questions about campaign finance and public money to support public questions. We're fortunate to have Carrie Lynn Krafteffer to tell us all about these issues in her previously recorded talk on election tips for local governments and electoral boards. So without further ado, we bring you another election special with Carrie Lynn Krafteffer. Engineer Rick, roll it.
Well, hello, everybody. We are back again with the third of our election law podcasts, and this one is going to address local government issues that come up during election time and how to convene an electoral board. So, if you're a municipal official or a municipal attorney or a municipal clerk, these might be issues that you want to deal with, as well as if you are a non-municipal official, but you are a governmental official, and you are in the midst of local governmental elections with your entity. So, here is the deal, okay? There's a lot of things that we have to do as governmental officials and attorneys during election time. There are the local election officials that we work with, such as the clerks and the secretaries, and we help them with filings, referenda, lotteries, for ballot position, objection processing, certification of ballot, and related issues. We sometimes have to advise our clients who are candidates for office. We have to advise electoral boards if they're convened. We have to handle questions related to campaign finance disclosure, political action committees, and we also have to address governmental questions that arise around election time, like the establishment of compensation for newly elected officials. We have to give advice about the transition of office holders, the regulation of political signs, incompatibility of offices, electioneering on public property, and all of those things. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So let's start out by talking about common areas of confusion. First, there's generally confusion about what's the difference between someone who's nonpartisan and independent. Don't those really mean the same things? Well, no, they really don't, but they kind of do. See, you can tell I'm a lawyer, right? Because I'm giving you a gray answer. So independent candidates are candidates who are running not as a member of any political party, but they're candidates in an election at which party candidates may appear on the ballot. And that sounds kind of confusing. But nonpartisan candidates are individuals who are running in certain units of government in which the statutes require candidates to run on a nonpartisan basis. So, for example, park district candidates are nonpartisan, as are school board candidates and library board candidates. Now, with municipalities, if you have a commission form of government or council manager government with councilmen at large, or if your village has adopted a system of nonpartisan primary and general elections under the municipal code, sections 3.1-25-20 through 3.1-25-60, then you are nonpartisan. And what that means is that you cannot file as affiliated with a political party. With municipalities, it also means you might have a runoff system of elections so that you will file for the primary, and then if you have a certain number of candidates that file, they get whittled down for the consolidated election. There's a distinction between political parties and political action committees. Political action committees need to be formed in the event that there are campaign finance disclosure requirements to be met. That's different than a political party, which really doesn't have to have a legal status, although a new political party and established political parties have methods that they have to run for office and a unique operational structure within the election code. So work with your attorneys if you have issues coming up with the formation of a political party. There's also a difference between what's a local election official and what's a local election authority. So a local election official is the person you have on site in your government who helps with election filings. It's either going to be your municipal clerk, your park board secretary, your library secretary, your school district secretary, whereas the local election authority is the person that governs the ballot preparation. So that will either be your county clerk or your board of election commissioners, if that's what you have, either for your city or your county. And what is the difference, finally, between a board of election commissioners and an electoral board? Well, a board of election commissioners is not the same as an electoral board. It's a board of election commissioners is the election authority in certain cities or counties if you have that established and your county clerk doesn't process elections, whereas an electoral board is a quasi-adjudicative body that comes into place very much like Brigadoon. It appears and you never know where or when, but it appears when you have objections filed in your community, and then this board has to convene to consider and process objections if you're a municipality or a township. So here is the deal. Right now, it is the end of November 2018 when I'm recording this, and we're already past the time period for nonpartisan candidates to file for the primary election, and we're heading into the time period where candidates can file for the consolidated election in April, on April 2nd, 2019. So if you are advising a municipal clerk and the clerk is still giving out information, make sure that your clerk provides the information with a disclaimer, double check signature requirements that they're going out, and make sure that your clerk issues a pre-filing notice or your secretary about the time and dates when filings will be accepted, as well as when objectors' petitions will be accepted. So during the filing period, candidates are required to file their nominating petitions in either the clerk or the secretary's customary office and within the customary office hours. Now, if your customary office hours are only part-time, it's okay for you to maintain those part-time hours, except on the last day of filing. On the last day of filing of petitions, you have to remain open until 5 p.m. On the first day for filing, the election official's office has to open at either 8 a.m. or your normal opening hour. That's in 10-6.2 of the election code. Now, on the last day of filing, you have to stay open till 5 o'clock. That's in section 1.4A of the election code. That's always hard to find, so I want to tell you where to find that. But here is the thing. That's only on the last day for filing petitions. It's not on the last day for filing objections, and there's some significance to that that we'll talk about in a little while. Now, what if your municipality or your governmental building does not have an official office? Then the clerk should receive petitions at a location and whatever times are determined in advance by the clerk. You still have to stay open until 5 o'clock, but you should give a general notice of the time and location of petition filing in a newspaper of general circulation, and also post that so that all the candidates have the same information. Now, clerks or secretaries, local election officials, have to issue receipts for and keep track of the documents that they receive. Clerks have to accept all nomination papers that are in apparent conformity with the election code and issue a receipt for them. The receipt should indicate what papers were received. I strongly suggest that you take a picture of the condition of the papers when they're filed. So if people are arguing whether or not there was a paperclip appending them together, you have evidence of that later and you know. So the receipt should indicate the date and time of the filing, what was filed, if there was a binding mechanism. The clerk should also date stamp and time stamp the nomination papers, and then the nomination papers have to be preserved for at least 6 months and made available for public inspection and copying. which brings me to my next topic, special FOIA considerations. FOIA is the Freedom of Information Act. There are issues that come up with the requesting of nomination papers. Because they're governed by the election code, there's a very short time to file objector's petitions. So public bodies should immediately comply with requests for nomination papers as fast as possible. You can charge your usual copying costs, but make sure that you charge costs equally to incumbents who are requesting petitions as well as to newcomers who are seeking to run for office. Municipal clerks and park board secretaries or local election officials need to distribute Form D5, which notifies candidates of obligations for campaign finance disclosure obligations. And what we suggest is that when you issue the receipt, that you also indicate in there that the Form D5 has been provided so that the candidates are acknowledging that. You should also review the procedures for simultaneous filing lotteries, which have to be held if multiple people file petitions at the opening hour of filing on the first day or within the last hour of the last day of petition filing. And there are requirements about the lottery that you have to give 7 days notice and you have to hold the lottery within 9 days. So what our recommendation is that you notify all candidates at the beginning of the filing period when they come to file when the lottery will be held so that they at least have the 7 days notice. Now, the other issue that will come up after nomination papers are filed are the certifications of the candidates' names or any public questions. So make sure that your clerks or your local election officials certify the candidates' names and the public referendum questions on the forms that are required by the local election authority and make sure they do that on time. If you do have objections pending to those, note that, and then you will have to do an amendment later. And the other thing I just want to talk about is apparent conformity. So the election code says that you have to accept all documents that are filed and certify them if they're in apparent conformity with the provisions of the election code, unless there's an objection filed, and then you'll handle that another way. But what constitutes apparent conformity? Well, apparent conformity is something that you can tell from the face of the petitions. So for example, if a candidate fails to file a mandatory document, that is obvious from the face of the petitions. You can refuse to certify a candidate under those circumstances. However, if you have a situation where, let's say that you know somebody lives out of town, you can't tell that from the face of the petition. That requires outside knowledge. You can't reject a candidate's petitions because of that, or you can't refuse to certify a candidate because of that. So the best thing would be for your local election official to wait and see if there's an objection. Because if there's an objection, that removes the clerk from having to make that decision independently. The clerk would also serve on the electoral board, so they might vote on those issues, but they don't have to make an independent determination as to whether or not someone should be on the ballot. We strongly discourage local election officials from rejecting documents under the doctrine of apparent conformity, because we don't like them to be sued and to have to defend themselves. But if you really believe you have a very clear-cut situation where a petition is defective on the face and your attorney tells you it's okay, then you can refuse to certify the candidate's name and give the candidate notice that you're doing that. Or if it involves a referenda, notify the primary referendum petitioner or proponent of the referenda of that. Okay, now, as far as advising candidates, I want to make sure that you are aware that the law has changed where one of the qualifications of holding office is that you can't be indebted to your municipality. And before, the law used to be that if you were indebted to a municipality when you filed your nomination papers and you certified in your statement of candidacy that you were qualified, you could be knocked off the ballot for attesting to a false statement of candidacy because you were not qualified because you had a debt at the time you filed nomination papers. Well, that requirement has been eliminated as far as running for office. So now you can run for office as long as you cure your indebtedness by the time you're sworn in. you will still be qualified to hold. So don't think of knocking anyone off the ballot for having an indebtedness to the municipality. However, you should look at the ballot forfeiture list, because if someone is indebted to the State Board of Elections for campaign finance disclosure fines, or there's an indebtedness there, they are ineligible to run for office. So make sure that you check ballot forfeiture list. Okay, so let's just briefly talk about electoral board procedures. And the first thing I want to talk about is the crazy timeline for filing objections related to the consolidated election. So the timeline for filing petitions is December 10th through 17th. And you need to file an objector's petition, if there's going to be anyone filed, within 5 business days from the 17th, which normally would be fine, but the 5th business day would be generally the 24th of December, which is a Monday in this instance, okay? Now, the election code defines a business day as any day that the local election authority or the State Board of Elections is open for at least 7 hours. If you receive an objector's petition, there are certain things that you have to do from a municipal law or from a... So let's review what those steps are, okay? So the first thing that we need to discuss is the WACO filing period related to the 2019 elections, okay? So the filing period for the candidates' paperwork is the 10th through 17th of December. Objector's petitions have to be filed within 5 business days from December 17th, which sounds okay until you realize that the 5th day that could potentially be a business day is December 24th, which is Christmas Eve. Now, the election code defines a business day as any day which the local election official's office is opened for at least 7 hours. So if your local election official's office is open a half day on Christmas Eve or closed on Christmas Eve, that's not a business day for you. So your objection filing period may end on December 26th instead. So don't worry if you're talking to people and neighboring public bodies have different deadlines for filing objections. That's because they're open different business hours or closed different business hours, so you don't have to worry about that. But whatever your deadline is, publish a notice of that, okay? Now, objector's petitions that do not include 2 copies thereof shall not be accepted. You need to inform your local election clerk official of that. That's a requirement in Section 10-8 of the Election Code, all right? So, if the objector's petition is filed without copies, they're not supposed to be accepted. It can be rejected. I believe if one is accepted without copies, it's the basis for potentially invalidating the objector's petition. When the local election official receives the objector's petition, the local official has to note the date and hour upon which the objector's petition is filed, and also not later than noon on the 2nd business day after the petition is received, the clerk has to transmit by registered mail a copy of the original nomination papers have to go to the chairman of the electoral board, and a copy has to go to the candidate who's being challenged. Now, let's talk about this for a minute, okay? So the first thing that I do if I'm advising local election officials, I figure out who is on the proper electoral board. Now, for a municipal electoral board, it's the mayor or village president, the clerk, and the longest serving trustee. And if 2 people are longest serving trustee, the person who serves is determined by lot. Okay. Now, a person is only disqualified for running for the same office or as the person who's being challenged. So if someone is running for mayor and there's a challenge to a mayoral petition, the mayor would be disqualified from serving on the electoral board. But one thing that I often hear is that, well, you know, so-and-so is out of town for the holiday, so they can't be on the electoral board. That is not a basis for substituting someone on the electoral board. Just like if a village trustee is missing, you don't appoint a different village trustee for that meeting. If a member of the electoral board is not available, you proceed with 2 people on the electoral board. That's still a quorum for doing business. So that's not a disqualification. And if you substitute somebody different in, it could be a void proceeding. So don't do that. So, if there are disqualifications, though, and you need to get additional people, you can replace a disqualified board member with the second longest serving board member. However, if there are further disqualifications, you can't continue to do that. You have to go to the circuit court, to the presiding judge, and have the presiding judge designate a public member. So be careful about comprising your electoral board. The other thing, the reason why I intervened to talk about that right now, and the other, well, a couple other things. First of all, if you're a school board or if you are a park board, your objections are going to be handled by the county or your board of election commissioners. You're not going to convene an electoral board, so you don't have to worry about some of those procedures. So mostly for municipalities that go through these procedures, the next thing I would do after I determine who the electoral board is going to be is I would start calling those people and I would find out when they're available for a hearing, because there's a very tight timeline for conducting the hearing and it's statutory. So let me just talk through the process and then I'll give you some examples as to how to handle this. So by noon the second business day after the objector's petition is received, the clerk has to transmit the objector's petition to the chairman of the electoral board. Now, we switch from business days to hours for the next thing that happens, okay? Within 24 hours of when the chairman of the electoral board receives the objector's petition, the chairman has to send out what is known as a call, telling people, which would be the electoral board, the candidates, and the objectors, when the electoral board is going to meet, and that day has to be not less than 3 nor more than 5 days after the chairman receives the nomination papers. So two things here. First of all, we're talking about calendar days here, not business days. And second of all, notice what I said. It's after the chairman receives the nomination papers. So if you have some wiggle room here if you are advising an electoral board. And let me just talk out how this could work for you, for example. So let's say that somebody files a petition on the 26th of December, and an objector's petition, and the clerk receives it then. The clerk has till noon on the second business day, which would be Friday the 28th, to transmit the objector's petition to the chair of the electoral board and to the candidate, right? I would call and I would figure out when is my electoral board available. Because if they're available the 2nd and 3rd of January, that's one thing. But if they're not available till the 7th of January, because a lot of people are out of town, then what I am going to do is I'm going to tell the clerk to transmit that document to the chairman of the electoral board by certified mail. And I am going to tell the chair of the electoral board not to open up that certified mail until January 2nd. Because if they, let's say that the clerk sees the mayor in the hallway on the 28th and gives the documentation to the mayor on the 28th, the mayor now has till noon on the 29th, which is a Saturday, to convene an electoral board meeting within 3 to 5 days, which is January 1st, which is a holiday. You're not going to convene a meeting on that day. So you're going to convene it the 2nd or 3rd of January. So you're very, very limited. So I would strategically advise the chairman of the electoral board when to receive those documents so that I could control the date of when the hearing is going to be. There's nothing illegal about that. Everything that I'm actually telling you to do is to comply by the law, but just do it in a way that you're adhering to these deadlines, okay? That is pretty much all I want to tell you about electoral boards, with the exception of two things that I want you to remember. One is that electoral boards are quasi-adjudicative bodies under the Open Meetings Act, so they cannot deliberate in private. It's an exception to an exception of the Open Meetings Act. There's an exception that says when quasi-adjudicative bodies are deliberating, they can go into closed session. But then that exception says except electoral boards. So electoral boards first must adjudicate and deliberate in open session. And second, they have to issue a written decision in open session. There are opinions of the Attorney General's Office, the Public Access Counselor, about both of those issues. So don't fall into that trap. The other thing I want to remind you also comes out of a PAC opinion, which is that, and I do not like this rule at all, and I will tell you some strategies to minimize problems, but electoral boards must permit public comment during their regular meetings and their special meetings, okay? So here's the thing. I have no problem with transparency and with the public being able to communicate during board meetings. I think it's a lot messier when you require the public to speak at an electoral board hearing. That's almost like saying, hey, when you're in court, the public can speak. Well, that is a bad idea for many reasons. Because first of all, the electoral board is taking evidence and considering evidence, and you can't just consider whatever anybody says. So I believe that electoral boards now need to adopt public comment rules. I believe they could probably adopt a rule that the public cannot comment on pending matters in an evidentiary way, although other lawyers might disagree with that opinion. But you have to be very careful. So electoral boards have to permit public comment. I would make sure that my public comment rules said that whatever is introduced by the public is not going to be considered as evidence, and it's only going to be taken, you know, for what it's worth. But be careful of that rule, okay? Now, let's talk for a moment about some things that happen after the election process. Well, no, let's stick with before. So let's talk about setting compensation for newly elected officials. So under the Local Government Officer Compensation Act, as well as the Municipal Code, compensation for incoming elected officials has to be established at least 180 days before the terms of office for the officers whose compensation is to be fixed, okay? So that has to be happening now. The problem with this is that in order to figure out your 180-day deadline, you really need to know when your officials are taking office. And for many of them, it is going to be at their first regular special meeting, either after the receipt of election results from the election authority, which is a flexible date that you can't really predict in advance. Now, because I'm talking about this in late November, chances are this deadline has already passed for many of you. But it is possible that it has not. So go ahead and work with your municipal attorney to back out those deadlines and just be aware of that. Some best practices are to establish a compensation formula in a written legislative act, like an ordinance or a resolution. Make sure that if you include benefits, like insurance or whatever, that that's spelled out also as compensation, and that you're spelling out insurance eligibility and other fringe benefits in your ordinance. You might also want to look at IMRF eligibility and consider whether or not that's going to be compensation and specify that in your ordinance, but you really have to be careful with IMRF eligibility rules with respect to that. The best practices are not to establish a different compensation structure predicated on who's going to win the election. For example, I once was involved in a township dispute where the township kind of said, well, if the elected official is, you know, a new official, they're going to get $5,000. But if they've been in office for 32 years or more, they're going to get $80,000. I mean, they were clearly helping the incumbent by establishing a bifurcated compensation schedule, and we sought judicial relief to invalidate that. So don't tinker around with that. Be uniform for whoever's in office. Now, let me talk about one thing, and this is related to change in compensation during term of office. Can a governmental body adopt a salary structure that provides for raises each year? What do you think? Well, the answer is actually yes, but let me tell you why this is an issue. First of all, Article 7, Section 9B of the Illinois Constitution says, an increase or decrease in the salary of an elected official of any unit of local government shall not take effect during the term for which that officer is elected. Now, there is an Attorney General's opinion that says midterm changes in the compensation of elected officers of units of local government are not flatly prohibited by the Constitution. Rather, the key issue is whether action is required during the term to effectuate that change. Now remember, the reason that we have this law is so that people can't determine their own compensation, and they can't penalize people they don't like. So they can't go into office and then vote themselves a raise, and they can't penalize people who are elected that they don't like. So before we know who the candidates are, we have to establish compensation that's going to be whatever it is, no matter who gets elected. The key here is that the increase or decrease can't take effect during the term for which the officer is elected. So it's very odd, but in some municipalities, if you have six trustees, three elected every 2 years, you might have elected officials who are compensated differently as trustees because some are establishing compensation for the newly elected officials who are coming in, but it might be different from the previously existing ones who are still continuing to serve in office if they're in the middle of their four-year terms. So basically, if the compensation is set in advance of the term, a salary can increase or decrease during the term because it's effective prior to the term. All right. The other thing that you need to review right about now, if you're an incumbent or if you're advising a municipality or public body, is look at the State Officials and Employees Ethics Act, which prohibits public officers and employees from engaging in prohibited political activity on compensated time. So on paid time, officials and employees cannot intentionally perform prohibited political activity, and you need to look at the statute to see what that is because it's a lot of things. They can't use municipal property for political purposes. Municipal or governmental employees can't be required to perform political functions as a part of their duties or during their time off. And you can't offer additional governmental salary or perks to people for performing that. So compensated time is defined as any time worked by an employee that counts towards minimum work time, but it does not include holidays or leaves of absence, vacation, personal days, or compensatory time. All right. Okay, so let's shift our focus now to electioneering. There is no electioneering within 100 feet of a polling place. A lot of governmental governmental buildings are polling places. You cannot electioneer within 100 feet of a polling place. That's a campaign-free zone, okay? Now, how the 100 feet are measured is a very complicated thing depending on where the polling place is located in your public building and if you have to use elevators or whatever. So walk through that with your attorney ahead of time so you know what the boundaries are. And you should know that anywhere outside of 100 feet on election day, it's considered a public forum, even if it's on public property. So if people want to electioneer at your school district building on election day, they can as long as they're outside of 100 feet. The same goes with campaign signs. So review section 17-29 about those requirements if you need to do that. And let's talk for a moment about political signs, okay? So municipalities can enforce rules to keep political signs off of their property except on election day. However, the ban then should be on all signs, not just political signs, or you are running afoul of First Amendment provisions. So section 19A-70 of the Illinois Election Code says that on election day, if you have a polling place, you have to permit campaign signs on public property outside of the campaign-free zone, even if the signs are on governmental property. Well, now this raises a question about early voting. What do we do if we are having early voting on our governmental property? That's not really an election day, is it? Well, section 17-29 was amended in 2013 to specify that if the polling place is conducting early voting, signs must also be permitted during the period when early voting is occurring, the whole time period, not just the hours when early voting is occurring. So be careful about that, okay? So let's see, are there any other topics that are going to come up that I forgot to tell you about? Oh, I forgot to talk about referenda. So let's talk about referenda. So sometimes public bodies are engaging in referenda and they're putting questions on the ballot, either advisory or binding. So there is a prohibition in Article 8, Section 1A of the Illinois Constitution that prohibits the expenditure of public fund for private purposes. And this also means that public funds cannot be expended to advance political interests, even if they are closely aligned with the governmental body's objectives. Municipal funds cannot be used for any type of political activities, including campaign strategizing, petition checking, referendum polling, and the preparation of campaign literature. And a municipal board cannot use public funds to support or oppose, and when I say municipal, actually I mean governmental, cannot use public funds to support or oppose any candidate or referendum, even if the candidates are unopposed or even if the referendum was initiated by the governmental body. Okay? However, the Illinois Election Code permits governmental bodies to expend public funds to disseminate factual information relative to a referendum. That's permitted by Section 9-25.1 of the Election Code. That means that public bodies may create and distribute factual information, such as official statistics about employments and programs, or demographics, or projections. They can give out results of community surveys of priorities. They can talk about the age and status of existing buildings and facilities, as well as the cost of providing services. And they can pay for the creation and distribution of information with public funds. What they cannot do is use governmental time or employees for political activities, but they can use them for informational activities. They can't use governmental facilities, copy machines, furniture, etc., for referenda advancing activities. And they can't use governmental computers or things that are paid for by the governmental body for political activities. So the best practices, if you're running a referendum, are to maintain a strict division between the government as a governmental entity and any pro or anti-referendum organizations. And one of the best examples I have of this is that a lot of times park districts are running referenda, and then you have the Friends of the Park, who are the advocates. And the Friends of the Park would be a separate not-for-profit corporation that would be set up to help the park district. But this way, that organization can engage in the election activities, and the park district can disseminate the information about the referendum. And a lot of times the people serving on both are the same, and that's fine. It's just really a strict division with respect to the use of funds. Now, the other thing is, just because you're a governmental official doesn't mean you lose your First Amendment rights. So you can still engage in advocacy activities in your spare time. You can pass out materials that you generated on your own time and at your own expense about a referendum. You can create a not-for-profit foundation to raise and expend funds supporting the referendum issues or opposing them. And you can send out emails stating what your position is. You don't have to be silent on this. You just cannot expend public funds. So those are my top tips on how you can survive during this election season. And I wish you luck. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Carrie Lynn. That was great. Best wishes to everyone this election season, but it is a special meeting and we have to have public comment. So let's look at one of the questions that we get. Question is, do we have to pay our public works employees when they are on call during the winter season in case of snowfall events? What do you think?
Yes.
As always, Rick, the question is like a definite maybe. But the answer to the question is a definite maybe. It's sometimes characterizing on-call time can be a little tricky. The general rule under the Fair Labor Standards Act, or FLSA, is that employees who are working on-call time are either engaged to wait or waiting to be engaged. And I don't know if you knew this, Rick, but my wife was waiting to be engaged for 8 years before we got married. And it's going well so far. So I think it was worth the wait.
Definitely.
We'll have to ask her. But as those descriptions suggest, though, an employer likely is required to pay an employee who is engaged to wait and does not have to pay an employee who is waiting to be engaged. Under FLSA, an employee who is required to remain on call on the employer's premises or so close thereto that he cannot use the time effectively for his or her own purposes is working while on call, and as a result, they must be compensated for their time. On the other hand, an employee who is free to come and go as they please, but be available by phone to come in if need be, within a certain reasonable period of time, is likely waiting to be engaged and does not need to be paid for waiting around. Naturally, this distinction is important for calculating whether an employee has earned overtime. To avoid the risk of a material FLSA claim for unpaid overtime, employers are wise to examine their on-call requirements to ensure they are defined and implemented correctly. An important thing to do year-round, but especially as the snow starts to fall. But in any event, we move on with our agenda to the Department of Public Works. Ansel Glink has about a dozen speeches and sessions coming up at the Parks Conference, IAPD, IPRA, Soaring to New Heights Conference, January 26th to 29th, 2019. The Illinois American Planning Association, Chicago Metro Section, has the bar exam coming, planning law session coming up in February. Stay tuned for that date coming up. And then the National Planning Conference is coming up in April 13th to 16th in San Francisco. I'll be talking about short-term rentals, and my friend David Silverman will be talking intergovernmental dynamics, politics, laws, and schoolhouses. So before we go, we want to remind everyone to subscribe and leave us a review wherever good podcasts are heard. We prefer good reviews. Email us your questions and show ideas at podcast@anselklink.com. And as always, visit us online at quorumforum.anselklink.com. Can we get a motion to adjourn?
Second.
All in favor, the ayes have it. We'll see you next time on Ansel Klink's Quorum Forum Podcast.